You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 16th of May, 2013, right here on Monocle 24.
Hello and welcome to Midori House on Monocle 24, live from Studio One in London with me, Sophie Grove, and Cordelia Lynch.
Coming up in the next 60 minutes, we'll be setting the day's news agenda with Majid Nawaz from the Quilliam Foundation. Majid, what do you have for us?
Well, I think there's three things I was keen to discuss. One, of course, the elections in Pakistan have happened. There's been a winner and a couple of losers. And the second thing was the Prime Minister's shuttle diplomacy to Russia concerning the Syria question. And the third was a domestic issue, and that's the Oxford child grooming case.
Also, it lifted a man for the first time into the skies, but what did it take for hot air balloons to take off? We'll speak to an author of a new book who says it's all about being a little mad.
It's quite clearly that some of the people involved with this were kind of showmen or indeed exhibitionists or pretty crazy people.
Also coming up, eight nations are meeting to discuss the future of the Arctic. We head to Sweden to find out what's at the top of the list.
Plus, we gear up for this weekend's finale of everyone's favourite singing contest, including mine, Eurovision. Fernando Augusto Pacheco will bring us his guide for Thursday's semi-final.
All that, plus we play some music too and have a flick through this morning's British front pages with a very special guest, Monocle's editor Andrew Tuck. So lots to come in the next hour here on Midori House.
But first, let's catch up with the headlines with Barney Burnham.
Monocle 24 News, I'm Barney Burnham. At least six civilians, including two children, have been killed and a number of others injured in a suicide bomb attack on a convoy carrying foreign soldiers in the Afghan capital Kabul. The bomber drove a car loaded with explosives at two armoured cars in an industrial area in the east of the city. A number of buildings were destroyed and a large area has been cordoned off. NATO says it's investigating reports of ISAF casualties. The head of the US Internal Revenue Service has resigned following the scandal over its targeting of conservative groups for special scrutiny. President Obama says he told Treasury Secretary Jack Lew to seek the resignation of Stephen Miller, the acting IRS commissioner. The president said new leadership was needed to restore public confidence in the IRS.
I've reviewed the Treasury Department watchdog's report, and the misconduct that it uncovered is inexcusable. It's inexcusable, and Americans are right to be angry about it, and I am angry about it. I will not tolerate this kind of behavior in any agency, but especially in the IRS, given the power that it has and the reach that it has in all of our lives.
The UN General Assembly has passed a resolution condemning the Syrian government for human rights violations. It also calls for a transition from the current regime, but the vote has no legal weight. 12 member states voted against the resolution, almost 60 abstained. The British Prime Minister David Cameron was at the UN as the issue was debated. He warned that it's important to keep talking to Syria's rebels.
If we don't engage with the opposition, then we shouldn't be surprised if extremist elements in that opposition grow. That's not what we want, and so we should be engaging, and that's the debate that will take place in Europe.
Bangladesh is evacuating 1 million people, with Cyclone Mahasan expected to hit its low-lying delta coast on Thursday evening with winds of around 100 kilometres an hour. Just over 4 million people are at risk from gale-force winds, heavy rain and flooding. A storm surge of up to 7 feet is expected to hit the delta. Two people reported killed, one crushed by a falling tree, another as he made his way to a shelter. The storm has already killed at least 7 people in Sri Lanka as it tracked across the Bay of Bengal towards Bangladesh. And at least 6 people have been killed and around 100 more injured after tornadoes swept through Texas. 3 tornadoes hit an area around Granbury, a town about 35 miles southwest of Fort Worth.
It's rough. Very rough. Everything's demolished.
What was it like when it hit?
It was like hail.
The house started shaking. We were in a closet. You could hear it. It sounded like a train going off. It was scary.
Houses are no more. They're all leveled.
For the destruction from 1 to 10, it's probably about a 10. I mean, there's nothing left over there, hardly.
Two health workers in Saudi Arabia have become infected with the potentially fatal new SARS-like virus after catching it from patients in their care. The World Health Organization says it's the first evidence of such transmission within a hospital. France has also reported a likely case of transmission within a hospital, but this was between two patients who shared the same room for 2 days. Those are the main stories here on Monocle 24.
Thanks, Barney. It's 5 minutes past the hour. You're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24.
London, New York, Tokyo. This is Monocle 24.
London, New York, Tokyo. To vai Monocle 24.
Londres, Nova York, Tokyo.
London, New York, Tokyo. Dette Monocle 24.
Londonist, New Yorkist, Tokyost. Se on Monocle 24.
London, New York, Tokyo, Monocle 24 desu.
Londino, New York, Tokyo.
This is Monocle 24.
You're listening to Midori House, live from Studio One in London. It's time now to get ready and set the day's agenda, choosing the three big stories you need to know over the next 24 hours. Majid Nawaz, co-founder and executive director of Quilliam, a global think tank focusing on religious freedom, extremism and immigration, among other things, joins us in the studio. Majid, thank you for coming in. Let's start on the Pakistan elections. Clear winners and losers, but that seems to matter less in some sense than the historical process of democracy that voters enjoyed.
Absolutely. This is the first time Pakistan has ever witnessed a peaceful democratic transition from one government to another after having completed a full term in office. And that's a big thing, of course. It's a good thing for democracy in the country, and it bodes well for the future stability of the country. It's almost poetic justice in the sense that the victor in this case, the soon-to-be or confirmed Prime Minister Nawaz Sharif, was the man, if we remember, that General Musharraf ousted in a coup in 1999. Nawaz Sharif was humiliated, arrested, and basically exiled to Saudi Arabia. And he now returns as Prime Minister while General Musharraf is under arrest for treason. So there's a bit of a poetic justice involved there, and the tables have turned. I think also people would be interested to see how Imran Khan didn't win. There were probably more profiles written by global journalists on Imran Khan than any other living being in that country, and yet he didn't win the elections. And that's an interesting thing to look at. One wonders why. He was very popular among the youth, among the urban elite, certainly among the Taliban, who backed him tactically in the elections because they threatened to blow everyone else up but him and Nawaz Sharif. He did win in the Northwest Frontier province, what's now newly named as Khyber Pakhtunkhwa, and that's the area that he belongs to ethnically as well. But he didn't win among the people that were his most vocal supporters, and that was the urban educated elite. And in fact, despite the fact that the country had a record 60% turnout, most people, and 60% of the country actually, hail from the province of the Punjab, which is Nawaz Sharif's province. He's ethnically Punjabi. And it seems that Pakistan simply voted along conservative, tribal and ethnic lines, as it always has done.
And do you think there is, to some extent, a disproportionate international press coverage of Khan? He certainly commands a lot of column inches. He's a charismatic leader, and obviously his past, which has floated in between his kind of celebrity relationships and profile, has perhaps distorted the picture of him.
Yeah, and that's nothing new. International journalism always seems to do this, especially with Pakistan. There's a level of Orientalism involved. There's a level of looking at it from an outsider's perspective and not really understanding the nature of the country. Nawaz Sharif's brother has been governor he's been ruling the province of Punjab for a very long time and has done wonders for the city of Lahore. Now, 60% of the country are Punjabis, and it's the economic powerhouse of the country, and also happens to be where most of the army chiefs come from. It's a crucial province, and Imran Khan's biggest flaw, sadly, and I say this, it's a sad thing, it's not a good thing, his biggest flaw is that he's not ethnically Punjabi, and the country voted along ethnic and tribal lines, and that's how it's always done, and foreign journalists and correspondents need to understand the country slightly better, I think.
Well, talking about ethnicity and in the UK, Pakistani men, looking at the Oxford grooming case, the Bullfinch trial, as it's known, it's become part of the debate now, post the trial, whether ethnicity is an issue and should be tackled. These were a group of seven Pakistani men that were found guilty of some horrific crimes involving young children. Do you think that's a legitimate debate to be having, that the police and councils should be tackling head on?
It's certainly a legitimate debate to be having. I run an organisation that tackles these issues head on. However, I think in this case, it's a red herring. I think that if we were discussing extremism, terrorism, if we were discussing importing forced brides to the country, then these are certainly issues that are prevalent in countries like Pakistan. Now, out of the seven men convicted, in fact, two were North African. So not all seven were Pakistani. Former Labour MP Anne Crier appeared on a radio show after the convictions and did blame Pakistani culture for this instance, for this incident and for the convictions. And I think that's a statement one step too far, because, of course, we know that we didn't blame the BBC for what Jimmy Savile did. We didn't blame white culture for what Jimmy Savile went on and continued to do for a long time. Paedophilia, child grooming is an issue, as the police in the area mentioned, that's prevalent among people from all racial and religious backgrounds. And I think it's unhelpful to the legitimate debate on immigration and to the legitimate questions about integration in this country, and certainly about the way in which many Muslims in the UK aren't as integrated as they should be, for various reasons, including for reasons that are to do with mainstream society as well. And that's a debate that we do tackle head on, but I think it's unhelpful to focus on this example as a legitimate example or a legitimate piece of evidence for that debate.
Majid, we should say that this is an issue that's been very much covered in the domestic papers here in the UK. It's really a failure on the state to protect some girls that were in care and then became exploited by a group of older men. Do you think this is really triggered in the UK, a sort of soul-searching? You know, are we looking after children in care? And, you know, the social services have really had to look at themselves and see, you know, is the system working?
I think there's been a series of sexual scandals that have come out recently involving media personalities, politicians, and common criminals, as in this case. And I think that the soul searching includes what you've mentioned, but goes beyond that into looking at the culture that we have that in some instances would turn a blind eye to sexual harassment, to sexual abuse, and to sexual grooming. And I think people have to take a lot more seriously the behaviour of men, especially, and normally men, who are in positions of authority over children, in Jimmy Savile's case, as young as 5 years old in hospital beds. And I think we have to be look into ourselves and start asking some very difficult questions.
Because certainly it was an organised group, and these crimes happened between 2004 and 2012, yet it was only actually investigated properly by the police in 2011, I think. Perhaps highlights the level of ignorance around the organised nature of these gangs.
Absolutely. We're getting better at taking cases of sexual abuse and complaints more seriously. We have moved beyond the days when people would say to a woman, oh, that's just because, you know, you have to get used to it. That's what men are like. I think that obviously there's a lot more to do, but things are improving.
Let's move on to another issue in the news, Syria. Now, quite an interesting meeting coming up between Prime Minister David Cameron and also Sergey Lavrov in Russia. Russia key to this conflict. I wonder whether you think this dialogue, this engagement with Russia really could be critical to peace talks and what we're going to see happening over the next couple of months in Syria.
I think it's key. I think there will be no solution to the Syria problem without a diplomatic solution being arrived at between the international community and Russia. I think Iran is also something that we need to look at very carefully, because they will continue to support and arm Hezbollah, who are intervening on the side of Assad. It's interesting at this stage to consider the news that just emerged from Syria, that a leading rebel fighter has been caught on camera eating the lungs of a defeated and killed Assad soldier. That gives us cause to worry because Cameron wants to lift the arms embargo, the British government policy that it's working on at this current stage as a result of the diplomacy with Russia, is to lift the arms embargo and allow the international community to funnel arms to the Syrian opposition. Now, this begs the question, and we have to start wondering whether we're arming people who are cannibals in this instance, this example. He was not just an average fighter. He was one of the leading rebels, and he said he would do it again. And it gave the impression that this has been happening and will happen again because people were cheering. There was a crowd around him. So we do worry about the nature of that. And I think the other thing we have to worry about is, again, funding arms into that country, not just to the secular opposition, but we have to worry about whether these arms get to the Al-Qaeda fighters as well. So I think the diplomatic solution must be the way forward at this current stage.
Yeah, and certainly a very critical time politically on the Syria case. Majid Nawaz, thank you very much indeed for coming in to speak to us, co-founder and executive director of Quilliam.
Coming up, we head to Sweden to find out what's making waves at the Arctic Council meeting.
Every weekend here on Monocle 24, we like to take a break from the rigours of our hard-hitting news agenda and have a leisurely look at the arts.
Anything can be made interesting by looking at something long enough or from the right angle.
Starting at 8 a.m. London time on Saturdays, the weekend edition brings you a mix of music, news and very special guests with me, Georgina Godwin.
I discovered that I was enjoying listening to it as a piece of music, not just as an installation in that gallery. I thought, this sounds like a new album.
I'll be talking to a variety of talent from the worlds of literature, music, theatre and television, as well as introducing you to new selections from our global playlist.
It's something entrenched and strange, and it's a mysterious relationship with your own creativity, and it's a lifelong negotiation.
That's the weekend edition, Saturday from 8 a.m. and Sundays from 16 to 1800 hours, London time, right here on Monocle 24.
Now, the Arctic is becoming more significant on the global stage with its abundant supplies of oil, gas and minerals and the opening of sea lanes. It's one of the reasons why this year's meeting of the Arctic Council in Kiruna, Sweden, is of particular importance.
Ministers from eight nations of the Arctic met and our foreign editor Steve Bloomfield was there. Steve joins us on the line from Kiruna. Steve, hi.
Hello, hello.
Good to speak to you. Now, there's some big news, really, from this gathering. China has been invited to have observer status. Invited is probably the wrong word because they've been jostling for this for some time. How significant is this?
They have indeed. China has a real interest in the Arctic. They have just signed a free trade deal with Iceland. They have various mining interests that they're trying to push forward in Greenland. And also, as you mentioned, with the sea lanes, as the Arctic begins to melt, they're seeing real possibility to send ships north over Russia through the Arctic to Europe and also to America, which would be a lot cheaper and a lot quicker than sending them south through the Suez Canal. So they've got a real interest in the Arctic. The question is, how do they try to exert some influence? And the Arctic Council is a group of eight nations, the five Nordic nations, Russia, the US and Canada, all the countries that have part of the Arctic Circle within their territory. And China, like a lot of other countries, including Japan, Singapore, South Korea, want to at least sort of have a better understanding of what's going on at these meetings. They want observer status. There was a bit of a ding-dong on Tuesday night over dinner between the eight foreign ministers who were here about whether China should be allowed, but eventually, after much heated discussion, they agreed that they should be allowed in.
And some objection as well from Canada over the EU getting observer status, Steve. How significant is the economic interest in a country's desire to be part of this council?
I think that the direct economic interest is minimal, but I think because the Arctic is becoming such an important part of the world, both economically and environmentally, a lot of countries want to be involved where the decision-making is taking place. So the European Union thought, well, if China's going to be involved and Japan's going to be involved, then why shouldn't we? Their only problem was that Canada has an issue with the European Union at the moment over seal hunting. The European Union is quite squeamish about the idea of seals being hunted. Canada says, well, this is our livelihood. And as the Canadian minister who's here, who's their northern minister, not their foreign minister, said, it's like, you know, if she sat down with the French minister and said, can I tell you not to eat coq au vin? The French minister would obviously be slightly upset. So for them, it's the same sort of thing. It's part of their livelihood, and they don't see a problem with it. So they found a bit of a fudge, and the European Union will be allowed to observe so long as they play nice on seals.
And Steve, give us a sense of how this meeting plays out. I mean, last time you went to the Arctic Council, it was very much a provincial affair, very cosy, put it like that. But this time there's some big guns there. But really, there was a sort of Arctic casual dress code that not everybody adhered to. Give us a sense of the atmosphere at this meeting.
Well, exactly. I mean, it is quite low-key still, even though you've got, John Kerry was here, Sergei Lavrov, the Russian foreign minister. Kiruna is a small town, about 18,000 people, right in the north of Sweden, the northernmost city, if you can call it a city here in Sweden. And certainly the day before this meeting started, you'd be hard-pressed to find any evidence. There were a few flags out. The city hall where the meeting was taking place had no security. I could just park my car right outside and wander in with no one stopping me. And even when Kerry and Lavrov were here, it was still pretty low-key. Yes, Arctic casual was the dress code, so which meant if you were Carl Bildt, the Swedish foreign minister, you were wearing a rather fetching Icelandic cardigan. If you were the Norwegian foreign minister, Espen Barth Eide, you were wearing a sort of rather strange grey and blue sweater with some polka dots on. And if you were Sergei Lavrov, then you decided not to wear your grey suit. You wore your dark blue suit. So he perhaps didn't quite take Arctic casual to the extremes. But there was this sort of quite relaxed atmosphere around the whole thing. You could sort of come and go pretty much where you wanted as you pleased. Security was quite minimal, and it made a real change from obviously a lot of other summits and events like this, where the security can get somewhat out of hand.
Well, Steve, good luck in Kiruna, and watch out for that 24-hour light. It can drive you a bit mad, I'm told. That was Steve Bloomfield, Monocle's foreign editor. Welcome back to Midori House, where the time is 11:22 in Dubai, 10:22 in Istanbul, and 8:22 here in London. The first time you see it, hovering above the horizon, floating in complete silence, you can't help but have a rush of emotion. Hot air balloons are what brought man into the skies for the first time back in 1783.
Since then, they've helped man in everything from science to exploration and even war. There have been success stories and a few tragic ones as well. The topic of hot air balloons is of such interest to author Richard Holmes that he decided to write a book on it, Falling Upwards, How We Took to the Air. Monocle's Phil Hahn caught up with Richard a little earlier and asked him why balloon flight captured his imagination.
The opening section, it just starts off with me 4 years old at a little country fete in Norfolk. Okay, and I have my uncle, who's an RAF pilot, who's 4 years old. I hero worship this guy. He's very tall. He's rather silent. And I can't remember why, but he took me to this fair. And they had the little stores, this would be in about 1950 or something, where they sell those early helium party balloons. And that was quite a new thing, and I'd never seen them before. And my uncle bought one without saying anything. He just tied it to the top button of my Airtex shirt. And of course, it pulled. It was a big red balloon. And I was 4 years old. I was hanging on to his hand. And I thought, wait a minute, this balloon is going to take me off. So I hung on very tight. And the only thing my uncle said, he looked down, he said, Richard, maybe you will fly. And nothing else. And he then took me up to a hill overlooking the fair. I could see everything, so the ground was beneath me. And then he let go of my hand. And I thought I was going to take off. I was going to fall upwards. Cut. That's the way the book opens. And the whole of the rest of the book comes out of that idea.
And do you think that's how perhaps historically is what captured figures about this idea of flight? Because it is such a magical thing, and it is such a beautiful idea to literally just float away.
Yes, yes. I mean, there's some good hard science behind it, which we look at. It starts in the mid-18th century. There are both English and French scientists, notably a man called Cavendish up in Cambridge, and Lavoisier, wonderful science in Paris. And they do this thing which we'd now call completely counterintuitive. They realize you can weigh ordinary air, okay? The air around us weighs something. It weighs so many pounds, so much, many cubic feet of it weigh a specific amount. They then discovered this new gas, which is called hydrogen. Lavoisier named it hydrogen. And they weighed this gas, and they discovered that it's 14 times lighter than atmospheric air. So it's like an invisible bubble in the air. And they thought, what can we do with this? The first time they tried inflating ordinary soap bubbles, which of course went straight to the ceiling. In fact, a man, a wonderful man called Tiberius Cavallo, member of the Royal Society, did this. And then in France, there was a company of paper makers called Montgolfier, a name that I'm sure will ring among your listeners, down in South France in the Ardèche. And they were, one of the brothers was very rather interested in scientific things. He'd read about this. And he thought, wait a minute, if we could inflate one of our paper bags, what a wonderful publicity idea this would be. And then somebody had to go up.
So back in 1783, coming up with this idea, I think you might say, oh, no offense to you and all other hot air balloonists, but you've got to be a bit mad. You've got to be a bit crazy. And that's a bit of a theme, isn't it, in your book?
Yes. I mean, the notion of basket case. I mean, we have, because it's quite clearly that some of the people involved with this were kind of showmen or indeed exhibitionists or pretty crazy people. And some of them are very, very serious and brave science people who wanted to know what's going on in the up air. And that's one of the themes that's developed through the book. The first, they wanted to send up a condemned criminal. And to the honor of the French, they said, no, the first man who flies will be a French scientist. And the two men flew. And they flew over Paris, 1783, Montgolfier. And then there was another French scientist called Alexandre Charles who made the first hydrogen balloon. So you had hot air and hydrogen. And then it's the story of what they thought they could do with it. Initially, they thought it was a revolutionary form of transport. You could fly from A to B anywhere. They soon discovered that's one thing you cannot do with a balloon. You can't steer it. But then they realized there are a whole lot of other things you can do with it. For a start, you can see the whole Earth differently. And one of the themes is the way the Earth, in its natural, the seas, the rivers, it's a wonderful thing of the first people to fly over Niagara Falls, what that is like. You begin to see the world differently from a balloon.
Well, that is one of the themes from the book, is how critical it really has been on human development. You know, it's played such a crucial role across science, across war, you know, across travel.
Yes, that's right. And what do you actually see from a balloon? For example, the first vision of the Victorian cities, a man called Charles Green, a British balloonist, who took balloons across London, for the first time they saw the difference in a vivid scale between the wealthy West End and the poor East End. And it looks different, it smells different, at night the light's different, there are all the fancy places up the West End in Mayfair. And down in the East End, it's much darker, the gin palaces, brothels, all the lighting. You suddenly see this world of Victorian city. It's just one thing.
And another one of the really lovely stories in the book as well has to deal with Napoleon, the great Napoleon. And there's a passage in the book I know you want to point out because it really does tell, I guess, the lunacy of just, you know, the concept of going up in a balloon.
Yes. Unexpected things always happen in balloons, all right? But let me read this tiny passage. In December 1804, Napoleon commissioned Gannerin, who's one of the great French balloonists, to construct and launch a massive, decorated but unmanned balloon to celebrate his coronation as Emperor of Paris. It was festooned with silk drapes, flags, banners, and carried an enormous golden imperial crown suspended from its hoop on golden chains. Having been successfully launched above Notre Dame during the coronation ceremony, this fantastic contraption flew southwards, right across France, and amazingly crossed the Alps during the night. The following day, it was spotted symbolically descending upon Rome, the imperial city, a triumph for Garnerin's craftsmanship. The huge balloon veered towards St. Peter's and the Vatican Palace, then swooped down low across the Forum. But here the symbolic triumph was turned into a propaganda disaster. The enormous golden crown became hooked on the top of an ancient Roman tomb and broke off, leaving the balloon to disappear with its banners flapping over the Pontine marshes. By unbelievable coincidence, or thoroughly appropriate luck, you can never tell with a balloon, the tomb upon which Garnerin's prophetic balloon had deposited Napoleon's golden crown was that of the infamous tyrant and murderous pervert, the Emperor Nero. Napoleon's name was hooped like a deck quoit over Nero's. Once this ill-starred news was efficiently relayed back to Paris by Napoleon's diplomatic service, Garnerin and his balloons began to fall out of imperial favour.
Do you think we'll ever come back to hot air balloons being a romantic, romantic thing?
I think so. Remember, these were still gas balloons, all right. But you're right. This, I mean, 1903 is the Wright brothers and so on. Then Blériot flies over the Channel. So it all goes to the aeroplanes. But yes, because in the 1960s, the actual hot air with propane burners started in America. And now they fly all over the world. They're here in the Somerset particularly. I flew regularly in Norfolk. And it's a huge thing. I say the balloon festival in America is as big as book festivals in England. And I recommend if anybody hears a balloon festival, go along and have a ride. Very occasionally they're a disaster, but they're very, very rare. And if they're run by good teams, it doesn't happen. And it's quite, you'll never forget the experience.
Richard Holmes there, and in other news, I should say, Cordelia did once get stuck in a tree at a balloon festival, up in a balloon. There's another iconic image to leave you, but Richard Holmes was speaking to Phil Hahn earlier, and he's the author of Falling Upwards, How We Took to the Air.
Now let's get in the next half hour of the programme. We'll be continuing our week-long series on everyone's favourite event, I say that with no irony, the Eurovision. But before all that, let's get the world news headlines with Barney Burnham.
Thanks, Cordelia. At least six civilians, including two children, have been killed and a number of others injured in a suicide bomb attack on a convoy carrying foreign soldiers in the Afghan capital, Kabul. The head of the US Internal Revenue Service, Stephen Miller, has resigned following the scandal over its targeting of conservative groups for special scrutiny. President Obama says new leadership is needed to restore public confidence in the IRS. The UN General Assembly has passed a resolution condemning the Syrian government for human rights violations. It also calls for a transition from the current regime, but the vote has no legal weight. Bangladesh is evacuating 1 million people, with Cyclone Mahasan expected to hit its low-lying delta coast on Thursday evening with winds of around 100 kilometres an hour. Two people have already been reported killed, one crushed by a falling tree, another as he made his way to a shelter. At least six people have been killed and around 100 more injured after tornadoes swept through Texas. Three tornadoes hit an area around Granbury, a town about 35 miles southwest of Fort Worth. Two health workers in Saudi Arabia have become infected with the potentially fatal new SARS-like virus after catching it from patients in their care. The World Health Organization says it's the first evidence of such transmission within a hospital. Those are the headlines at the bottom of the hour here on Monocle 24.
Thanks, Barney. It's 33 minutes past the hour. You're back with Midori House on Monocle 24 with me, Cordelia Lynch, and Sophie Grove. This week, the Urbanist team is taking a look at the way we work in the city, from pop-up retail culture to the CEO who doubles up as a mayor, to the unemployed in Copenhagen using storefronts instead of the internet to get their CVs noticed. For this week's preview of the show, we're heading to Spain.
with all this talk of work, it's just about time to put our feet up and have a siesta. And what better place to take a break than in the Spanish capital, Madrid? The siesta has always been considered a sacred institution. But our correspondent, Liam Alders, has noticed that the city is waking up from its slumber in recent years. Amongst all the pillow talk, he found that the siesta is fast becoming a daydream as working patterns change and businesses adapt to a more challenging economic environment. However, before recording his citywide snooze fest, he decided to go to the true home of the siesta, Andalusia. And what better authority to talk on the matter than the Cordoba's local councillor of local traditions and parties?
Ah, the siesta. It's one of the staples of Spanish culture, and perhaps one of the reasons that the Spanish are often perceived as carefree or even lazy when it comes to work. However, this perception may have more to do with that slow-moving line at the Spanish post office than it does with the actual facts. The Spanish actually work longer hours than most Europeans, with an average of 1,725 hours. To put that into perspective, the hard-working Germans actually work less, with 1,659, while on average the French only clock up 1,580 hours. However, do longer hours actually mean higher productivity?
Ayuda muchísimo. A mí personalmente muchísimo.
For me personally, it really helps. When we have a lunch booked in a restaurant, I always say that I don't like going because it means having to miss out on these 5 minutes. And these 5 minutes are vital for me.
Y para mí son vitales.
As Emilia Caraquet, the councillor for local traditions and parties in the southern city of Córdoba, explains, long hours often call for some essential shut-eye midway through the daily grind. And Spain's 2, sometimes 3 hour lunch break allows for more than enough time to go home, eat, and even take a quick nap.
I would like to stay open, but the thing is, in that time I close because it's the tradition in this area.
This is Thelia from the eccentric designer furniture showroom Kika Keller. Like many small businesses, she closes up shop during the lunch hours.
When I close Kika Keller, I go around and I try to find the shop are open, you know, because it's the time that I have to buy something.
Do you have a siesta in the middle of the day ever?
No, I would like to do.
It is true that more time for lunch and asleep are also conducive to less stress and generally less rushing. I ask Thelia whether this means a healthier work-life balance.
Here in Spain, we are more happy than other country. Here in Spain, we like to make time to have a life.
But as the modern demands of working life have gradually eaten away at the refuge of lunchtime, many office workers in the capital, unable to make it home, have begun demanding shorter lunch breaks and hence shorter working days.
Basically, like everyone here in Madrid, they work like four hours, and then they have like one stop for a couple of hours to get lunch and then get a siesta. Well, where is the typical siesta time, you know? 2 hours or more than 2 hours, it depends. But that means that you finish your work later on.
This is Antonio. He is one of the growing number of workers that have opted for a more flexible working arrangement, threatening the very existence of the siesta.
I usually work from 10 to 6:30 because I just have like a half hour to get lunch, no more than that. And I think it's much better actually because then you have all the evening to do whatever you want, you know?
Do you think as well the people that don't adhere to this different arrangement in your workspace, do you think that when they come back after their 2 or 3 hour lunch break, they're less productive because they've been relaxing for so long?
I would say so, yeah, because, you know, I mean, when you just to work like the whole morning and then, you know, you stop for like 2 or 3 hours, then you have to start again. You have to restart everything again, you know?
Other businesses are also adapting to the changing mood in the city, and the Anton Martin market, which used to close between 2 and 5:30, has given its stalls the choice to stay open all day long. But as Jesus the butcher explains, it hasn't exactly been a roaring success.
It means we work more hours per day, but the truth is that the customers still don't come during this time. People just aren't used to the market being open all day. For many years, they've been accustomed to coming between 9 a.m. and 2, and 5 to 8 p.m. The interval between 3 and 5 is still quiet because old habits die hard.
According to Jesus the Butcher, this goes both ways, with the majority of the surrounding stalls deciding not to open all day long. This means that from the outside, the market still appears to be closed, often deterring potential customers.
Do you think it makes sense for a food market to close during lunchtime so people who want to have lunch actually can't buy ingredients?
I think it's great that the market is open because it's good for everyone and it suits some customers to do their shopping at this time. But the whole market should be open, not just a few vendors. If the market has 80 stalls, then it shouldn't be the case that only 20 are open and 60 are closed because people won't come.
If the Anton Martin market illustrates how changing attitudes are fighting entrenched customs, then the Retiro Park is another hotspot of siesta controversy. During the warmer months, many drift into the city's iconic park for a quick siesta in the shade. However, talking to one of the resident policemen there, they apparently do so at their own peril. While the exhausted workers are fast asleep, it seems as if some cunning and wide-awake thieves have been making a business out of their unconscious prey.
In the park's rest areas, for example, people find a spot to get some sleep, and then these thieves take the opportunity to make off with their belongings. During this time, people let their guard down, and this is when we usually have more thefts, in the later hours of the afternoon. The park is quite full and people usually lay down quite close to one another. And the thieves lay close by, pretending to rest. And when the person in question falls asleep, they can easily steal what they want.
Now, while it could be argued that these people are victims of their own laziness, it is true that the economic crisis is forcing many of Madrid's business owners and workers to wake up. And as they awaken from their slumber, the sacred siesta may gradually become a thing of the past. It's convincing Spaniards to forego their 3-hour lunch breaks, which may present more of a challenge. For Monocle in Madrid, I'm Liam Aldous.
And for more on the way we work in cities, tune in to The Urbanist at 0600 in Auckland, 1900 London time, and 1100 in San Francisco.
You're listening to Midori House. We'll be right back after this with everyone's favourite pastime, Eurovision. And Sophie, you love it, I understand.
I do. I'd like to just get that on the record now.
Confession.
I'm not a sceptic.
The Monocle app puts Monocle 24's pacey mix of current affairs, business, culture and music in your pocket. Whether it's midnight in Marunouchi or sunrise in Sydney, tune in to our around-the-clock audio service live from Midori House. Or download and replay your favourite programmes using the Time Shift feature. Also at your fingertips, our complete global travel guide. Get all this and more on the go on the Monocle app.
You are listening to Midori House. The time is 42 minutes past the hour. And now it's time for what we promised, our Eurovision series part 4. This time, our Eurovision expert, Fernando Augusto Pacheco, guides us through tonight's second semi-final.
If you thought the disco balls and amazing eyebrows of the first semi-final was a bit too much, well, expect more of the same on tonight's event. From Azerbaijan to Norway, 17 countries will compete for 10 entries today. Here's what Fernando has to say.
So here we are again. After Tuesday's semi-final, in which we had disco balls, impressive eyebrows, and even an 8-foot giant on stage, be prepared for more in this evening's second semi-final. This time, 17 countries will be competing for a place in the final on Saturday evening. Moldova, Lithuania, Ireland, Estonia, Belarus, Denmark, Russia, Belgium, Ukraine, and the Netherlands are already in, plus the UK, Germany, Italy, Spain, and France. And of course, last year's winner, Sweden. But let's talk about tonight. Here's your guide. Not my kind of thing, but the Albanians are going for more heavy rock style. Maybe they think he worked with Lordi in 2006, so he worked for Dan again. Not too sure about that.
Find it, that's your reason.
But don't worry, there are plenty of ballads, including the entry of Azerbaijan. The winners of 2011 decided to send a strong romantic ballad as their entry. This is Farid Mamadou with Hold Me.
I'm lost in your smile, free falling from my...
For some cool Greek Balkan fun, I have to say the Greek entry impressed me with Alcohol is Free.
Μας βγήκε η τρικυμία μέσα στην εγνατία. Από φόρια μας τραβάνε στα νυχτά. Σαλάτος να μη ρώτα ποιος παίζει με τα φώτα. Κι η πλώρη μας τραβάλια τρεπένα.
Stay in the Balkans, I highly recommend the Bulgarian entry with some lovely traditional Bulgarian sounds. Note, this year we'll have a band with the oldest ever musician to be on the Eurovision stage. The 95-year-old Emil Ransauer will represent Switzerland with his band Takaza with You and Me. But my personal favorite of the night is the Norwegian entry, Margaret Berger, and her sleek electropop is fascinating. It is scarily named I Feed You My Love.
I have the future on my tongue.
That's it for today. Enjoy this evening semi-final. And remember, Saturday is the big day. For Monaco, I'm Fernando Augusto Pacheco.
Nobody does it better than Fernando, and we should say he is flying over to Malmo to cover the event for Monaco 24. Make sure you listen to his updates on the semi-final results on Monaco Daily at 2200 London time. A few days ago, he also met the Finnish contestant, Krista Sigrid, in the studio here in London. Krista is also competing for a place in the final tonight.
First, Krista, just tell us about the song. I know it's called Marry Me.
Yes, it's called Marry Me. And there's a story behind the song. I actually wrote it to my boyfriend because we've been together for such a long time. And yeah, I want to marry him. So I wrote the song as a little hint to him that he could propose soon.
And I saw the video as well. You do quite a lot of things, you know, until the marriage gets properly done.
Yeah, exactly. I think the music video is really funny.
It is very funny, like when he's in the bathtub and then suddenly...
And you can see that I'm in charge. Me and the Ding Dong Girls, we are the ones in charge.
Who are the Ding Dong Girls?
Well, Team Ding Dong is my team. And it's a really happy team. And the best thing is that everybody can join our team. And if you just like the song or like us or our energy, so you can just join. And the girls, the Ding Dong Girls, are the ones that will be on stage with me in Malmö.
Shall we hear a little bit of the song?
Yes.
And Krista, I also heard, I mean, I know this song's about your boyfriend, but come on, this is becoming like some sort of national anthem for gays as well, you know?
Yes.
Tell us more. There's even a parody viral video going on the internet.
Yeah, I love the gay parody. I want everybody to be able to sing the song. I want everybody to sing the song to the person they love. And I think that everybody should have the opportunity to get married. Everybody should be able to marry the person they love.
And I think that's such the right moment to release such a song, because everybody's talking about it in France, in the US, you know, there's a lot of discussions.
Yeah.
New Zealand just approved gay marriage. Tell us about Finland, your home country. How's the gay rights situation there?
Well, I'm a bit disappointed because Finland is a modern country, but gay marriages are not allowed in Finland yet. But we're going to change that for sure.
Playing Marry Me on the background.
Exactly. And Team Ding Dong and me, we're trying just to help. If we can do anything to help, we'll do it, because I think it's wrong. I think that everybody should have the right to get married.
And what was your career before? I mean, what did you used to do?
Well, I've been working as a professional musician now for 4 years. I've been doing a lot of gigs performing in Finland. And I've been also working at the theater. I've been doing a lot of musical roles and, yeah, stuff like that. But now I'm releasing my debut album. I'm doing my own music, and I'm so thankful for this opportunity.
What do you have to do as an Eurovision? I mean, first you're chosen, right?
Yeah.
How did you get chosen in Finland? Is there some sort of reality show, or someone just picks
you? We have a competition and a lot of contestants, and then we have a jury, and we also, the people can also vote. And yeah, Team Ding Dong got a lot of votes. So now we're here representing Finland in Eurovision Song Contest, and it's been a really crazy schedule. I've been doing a lot of promotion and interviews, and then I've been recording my album, so I haven't had any free time at all.
I have to ask you, have you ever met the previous Finnish winners, the band Lordi? Are you a fan?
Of course I am. It was the best thing that happened, you know, when Lordi won Eurovision. That was so crazy. I love them. I thought their show were great. Haven't met them like live, but they sent greetings to me when I won Eurovision in Finland. They were like, "You go, girl." They loved the show. Yeah, that's really sweet.
I'm sure you'll be as lucky as Dan. And I have something to tell you, Krista, as well, to practice my Finnish even more. Onea Eurovisuin him.
Oh, thank you so much. Kiitos, kiitos. That was really good.
So, Krista, just to end, what about your next projects? I've heard you've recorded a new video as well.
Yes, my next music video is called Amen.
Oh, wow.
It's a really hot and sweaty and sexy video with a lot of girl power. And it's my personal revenge song, and it's a really... Yeah, people going to be dancing for sure.
So it's not all about Marry Me, it's about...
No, now it's
splitting
revenge.
Yeah. Oh, revenge, nice.
Yeah, and we're dancing a lot in the video, and I think it's really cool. And you'll be able to watch it after Eurovision.
That's your next single after Marry Me.
That's my next single, and I hope you're going to love it.
Absolutely. Thank you so much, Krista.
Thank you.
I think she may have found a new recruit to the Ding Dong Girls. That was our researcher, Fernando Augusto Pacheco, talking with Krista Siegfritz. Now you're listening to Midori House with me, Cordelia Lynch, and Sophie Grove. And it's time now for a check of today's front pages. We're joined by Monocle's editor, Andrew Tuck. Great to have you here, Andrew. And we start with the story, survey on iPads and the impact of children reading them.
This is a story picked up by the Daily Telegraph, and it comes from the National Literacy Trust. I can't even say the word. That's not very good, is it? Now, they're based here in the UK, and they've surveyed over 34,000 children. And they found some very interesting things. First of all, children who tend to read books on e-readers, they don't have favourite books because they kind of glance them and then there's the next one to download. So there's a concern, first of all, that, you know, that many children, they get through their kind of young years by having these books they go back to again and again that they really love, that become parts of their narrative as children. And that just isn't happening. Younger children just don't have favourite books anymore. So it's interesting, as publishers kind of push to get more children reading on e-readers, there's a concern about that. But what's more important is that they discovered that when they tested children's reading, children who were reading mainly on an iPad and children who were reading on paper, it was the children on paper who had better reading standards. Now, Is that all down to the iPad, or is that because actually middle-class parents are more concerned about this and, you know, they kind of insist on their children reading well and won't let them have iPads? It's a little bit to be unpacked. But certainly what they're finding is that there's a really worrying trend that, you know, if your kids are only reading on iPads, then it's quite likely that their reading will suffer. And what's interesting about that is we're seeing schools already saying, actually, we're going to go over to iPads. You know, kids don't need to, you know, bring in books. You know, this is the future. And there's a real pause here, I think, for what we do about that.
It's quite interesting as a test case for the whole industry, really, just how we relate to the object of a book. I mean, children really do have that favourite, as you say, and sometimes they even memorise their favourite books more or less off by heart. And I wonder whether that's sort of indicates how adults also relate to books and the whole market, you know, in general.
I also wonder, what's interesting is, I wonder if you're a parent and you've got to read your child a bedtime story and you've been on a laptop all day at work, I wonder if it's making reading a bit more of an isolated experience, that you kind of don't want to kind of cozy up with your kid and get your laptop out again or another iPad out again to read a book. So you allow your kind of child to be on their own a bit. And then, you know, the fact is that lots of children's books become their favourites because their parents love them. And if their parents aren't involved in that process anymore, then that's, you know, it's an interesting debate. And also, they've also highlighted the fact that the number of children reading newspapers has absolutely collapsed. So young children and young people, 46% of them read a newspaper in 2005. Now only 31% do.
Terrifying. Well, move on to another story. I see you've got a clutch of papers
got a lot
there.
Now, it is a kind of funny story, but there's also good stories of today about the role of women in the media and things. But this is the story about the Barbie house, which is opening in Berlin. This is a life-size house just for Barbie. It's 2,500 square metres, and you're going to pay 15 euros to be able to go and visit it. And it's got everything. You know, you can try on Barbie's clothes, you can have your hair done like Barbie. But there's a huge protest going on in Berlin. Lots of women's groups are saying this is, you know, absolutely outrageous. And one person said, you know, pink is now the colour of seduction, cuteness, large eyes and big eyelashes, and it stands for everything to do with external appearance. And she's one of these people who said that they're going to picket this house being opened. And so it's funny, what seemingly is just about, you know, a toy company trying to make some money has actually, especially in Berlin, which is very rooted in kind of the protest politics, has caused a big furore.
Yeah, it's an interesting in a city, you know, known for its counterculture and vibrant arts, that something that, you know, fairly commercial would be set up there, really. Do you think enough people are going to attend in the first place?
Well, oddly, I think kids still love Barbie. You know, I think I understand what the nub of this is, you know, that you shouldn't just kind of like say to kids, you know, right, girls, you have Action Man, and boy, you have Barbie. Mm. And I must say, as a kid, I was rather jealous of my sister having Barbie, because you could do things with her hair. Action Man just had a plastic head. What are you going to do with that? But anyway, they have this group now called Occupy Barbie Dreamhouse, and 2,000 people have signed up for it. And they say they're going to have police and barricades outside to protect Barbie.
Wow, there's an image. There is a terrifying image. And the anti-pink movement. Very, very briefly, do you have another story?
Just one. A story that we've been covering many ways here on Monocle 24. The Dutch, a TV company, forced their finance minister to sit down and watch on a laptop stories of Bulgarian families coming to the Netherlands who'd found a loophole to take money out of the tax system, out of the benefit system. And it's now been revealed that probably 95 million euros was lost in Dutch taxpayers' money to criminal gangs from Bulgaria. Mm-hmm. And yesterday he managed to survive a confidence vote. But it's really kind of gone to the root of this really big concern in lots of European countries about how their tax is being used.
Andrew, the Bulgaria story unfurls. Well, that's just about all we have time for today. Thank you to our producer, Phil Harm, and Thomas Lewis. Our researchers were Fernando Augusto Pacheco and Lily Hess. And our studio manager is Alex Fennell. Up after the news is Culture with Robert Bound. And then at midday London time, Andrew Tutt will be back with The Briefing. Emma Nelson and Clemency Burton-Hill will be back with this show about the same time tomorrow. Thanks for listening. Goodbye.
A Rolex timepiece represents an ongoing commitment to innovation, horological expertise, and the passion of skilled watchmakers. all add up to make the one principle by which Rolex lives, that greatness is a journey that never ends. Rolex.